the most important meal of the day, second breakfast. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Second Breakfast podcast. I'm Andy Roth alongside Phil Duvall. Say hi, Phil.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. It's so good to be with you all. It is Wednesday, after all.
It is Wednesday, and that means it's a good day to be with Second Breakfast Nation. It also means, Phil, it's time
for... Yes, tell me.
It's time... Phil, I will tell you. It's time for another installment of Project Melway. Not just any installment.
Wait a minute. Is this the same... Is this the same Project Melway that is brought to you by the Gibsonian Institute?
The very same, Philip.
Fantastic.
Yes. Yes.
Andy, what episode of Project Melway is it? Tell everyone. Tell them.
Folks, I'm sorry for the next 45 seconds to a minute and a half of your lives. It is episode 30 of Project Melway, or as we have been numbering them in Roman numerals, episode triple X.
Hello, Mel Gibson. How are you today? All right, that's all I got. I'll do more later on, but I'm just so excited that. But here's the thing: we had a mailbag triple X and didn't talk about it at all, and it was so sad. So I figure we have to make at least one joke about it.
By the way, folks, it was only sad for Phil. I knew it was mailbag triple X, and I studiously avoided saying anything.
But how long is it? How long is it? The movie that we're going to be talking about.
2 hours 45 minutes.
Such a long movie. Such a long movie.
Indeed, I agree.
Okay.
Hang on.
Do you want to tell everyone what Project Melway is, or do you want me to?
I will. We were thinking the same thing. I will. Because you're part of my heart. Okay, I will tell people what Project Melway is. Project Melway, brought to you by the Gibsonian Institute. Folks, the Gibsonian Institute is a shadowy cabal of the five or six most powerful men in the world, and they have tasked us with the five most powerful men in the world, known as the Pentaveret. They have... didn't think you were going to get a soy murder and axe murder thing in this, did you? So... They have tasked us with watching all of Mel Gibson's movies in chronological order, starting with.
And we're up to the task, America. We're true. Up to the task.
Starting with that Australian summer surfing epic, Summer City, right? That was the first one, right? Moving through the Mad Max movies, moving through the Lethal Weapon movies, and we're approaching the present day. As you do when you do things in chronological order. We're approaching the present day, and
we're not getting further away from it.
It's true. And we talk about the movies. We talk about Mel and his development as sort of the prototypical movie star in many, many ways.
Yeah.
Yes. And we have we're in the home stretch. It's a long home stretch, but we're in the home stretch. And today, Phil, what are we talking about? What movie are we talking about?
Just a second. I want to say something. Breaking news. Oh. Breaking news.
What's that?
Well, you know that we're going to be finishing up right around the time that Machete Kills, the sequel to Machete, comes out. And he's in that. And he plays the bad guy.
Indeed he does. And indeed we will.
It looks like he may be signing on to play the bad guy in Expendables 3.
Indeed. Indeed it does
and
look
I,
like
And
that.
I have not seen Expendables 1 or 2, which means now I'd have to do this correctly.
Yes.
But if it doesn't. But the other thing about it is, it's a whole interesting development wherein Mel Gibson's got a new life as playing bad guys.
He's functionally turned...
Which he refused to play before.
That's right. He's functionally... This is basically a storyline from 1980s wrestling. He's basically turned heel.
It's amazing. Okay, so today we're talking about... That's our breaking news. Today we're going to talk about a movie called The Patriot. Mm. And The Patriot is a movie that came out in 2000...
Mm-hmm.
It is a movie that I loved when I saw it in the theaters. It is a movie that I no longer love.
It's a movie that just to
the fact
add my
that I
voice
might
to
hate it.
It's a movie that I liked when I saw it, and I definitely hate it now. So there's that.
I walked out of the theater like America, and then and then I walked out of the. Well, I didn't walk out anything. I turned it off from my TV the other night, just like. Oh, fine. Just
And then put a brick through the screen of your TV for having the audacity to show you the movie.
Yeah, I just crushed everything. It's what I had to do. You had to do it sometimes.
You do have to do it sometimes. It's true. Do you want to give the plot synopsis of The Patriot?
I guess. Okay, it's here. It is ready. The Revolutionary War is won by Mel Gibson. The end. Picture this.
Oh no.
Charleston, South Carolina, 1776. Mm. The film opens upon a group of people from South Carolina, none of whom have accents, and apparently none of whom own slaves. In Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah, the way they handle race relations in this, the race relations in this movie are just absolutely absurd. They're just absurd.
Okay, I want to go on record before we even start talking about this as saying, Mel Gibson, I'm about to thrash this movie, and I thought you were fantastic in it.
He is very good.
Fantastic.
Yes.
One of your best performances.
I agree with that.
And what I'm about to say about this movie for the next, what Andy and I will say for the next 30 minutes or so, none of it's going to be kind to the movie.
Yes.
It is. So know that going in, Mel, because I know you watch these, that we haven't liked some of your movies, and this is one of them, but I really, really, really do like his performance in this movie.
I really do too. No irony, no sarcasm. I agree with you.
One of his best performances, just wasted. Not even wasted, because it's still there. It's there. You can see it. But it might be the only reason this movie is watchable, to be completely honest with you. Because there's a lot of fun moments that I think he helps make entertaining. So the movie starts in Charleston, South Carolina at the dawn of the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And they're deciding whether or not to join the cause. The Congress of the South Carolina, or whatever they decide to have, whatever just the group, the townsfolk, decide to join the war over the protests of Mel Gibson's character, Benjamin something something.
Martin.
Mel Gibson's character is...
Benjamin Martin.
Benjamin Martin. Okay. I thought you were saying actually his name is Martin. I was like, I could have gotten them both wrong. That's fine. Benjamin Martin is famous for having fought for the English as a colonial in the French-Indian War,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And had done some awful, terrible things, was a war legend. His family knows him as a war legend, yet he is unabashedly against fighting anymore. And we set this up, and he's got a son played by Heath Ledger who wants to go into the colonial army and fight, be part of the rebellion, as they say. And he does against MG's objections.
Mm-hmm.
How much, I mean, here's the deal. This is a 3-hour movie and it's actually got a ton of plot. So how much are we really going to talk about here? Cause I'll do the whole movie if you want. No, but honestly,
to sum up, it's a guy who is forced into, through circumstance, participating in the militia force in the standard American Revolutionary Army, but the militia.
Right.
And he actually loses quite a bit of his family over the course of the movie.
But the important thing is that he stays alive and finds a love interest. I think that's the important thing.
It's true. It's true. And
it doesn't matter how many children of his and friends of his that die, because he stays alive and gets to marry his dead wife's sister. So I think it all evens out, really, in the end.
It does. It doesn't even out, because MG always comes out on top. Boom.
Boom!
But that's it. And strangely, the Revolutionary War comes down to the personal vendetta of Mel Gibson versus
very evil colonel.
Very evil colonel. Played, I mean, it's amazing there's any scenery left, because he chewed all of it. Jason Isaacs, who you will know as Lucius Malfoy, from the Harry Potter movies.
When he was in this movie, I thought of him as a poor man's Jeremy Northam. But Jeremy Northam has got considerably less work, and I actually think Jason Isaacs has done a fantastic job as Lucius Malfoy, and has his career has gone. And it turns out, well, of course he didn't do great in this movie, because his part is so one-dimensional. But, I mean, he's certainly hateable.
Yes.
Disgusting. Disgustingly hateable.
I will go farther. I will go further. I don't think he's anything elseable. I think he is only hateable.
This is a movie that is a stent. There's so much to say about this movie. If I It's just that I don't want to say it. But there is so much to talk about, and it's almost like we could talk about this movie for 4 hours, and that wouldn't help anybody out.
No.
But I think there is a lot to say about it, because there's the way that it goes wrong in so many spectacular, bold ways that you could talk about those ways. You could talk about how disgustingly anti-English this movie is. You could talk about how it turns the English into Nazis. You can talk about how it looks at the founding of America, not about the principle of freedom as an idea, but more as like how personal freedom is mixed in with protection of family. Like it is in some level like deeply profoundly American, in the sense that it's trying to show this rugged fight against colonialism in this sort of rugged, like, he doesn't do it because I'm against oppression, but when oppression finally hits his family, he fights back.
Yes.
And unrelentingly. And in the end, the final scene, he's carrying the flag that his son sewed.
Mm-hmm. Because the symbolism wasn't thick enough by that point.
Right, no, but at least it's like, it shows that, I'd like to say that it starts out personal and becomes about America. I don't think it ever stops being personal, but I think the filmmaker is trying to make the statement that the personal and the political are all mixed up together in America.
I think that's right.
And that's fine. I can't, and so it ends with him killing, killing the main bad guy, is tied up with the great victory that never actually happened in real life. And did I mention that none of them have Southern accents and none of them own slaves? There's like one slave owner. This is Charleston, South Carolina. There's this one slave owner, and he gives away his slave to fight. And Benjamin Martin, who is just the ultimate patriot and understander of human freedom and liberty, is like, I'm not going to let him fight unless he decides to fight for himself. And he's like, I'm going to fight. And then, like, and I'm not trying to make fun of black people. I'm saying that's the way, that's, of course, the character talks like that.
Yes, right.
And then, you know, and he's the one black guy.
Right, his name is basically Token.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure his name is, like, Darky or something awful. Like, it really is just, like, or Boy. I think his name might be Boy. And then there's another token white guy played by Donald Logue, or horribly played by Donald Logue, and I love Donald Logue.
I know.
Donald Logue is a great actor, and he is, well, maybe he's not a great actor, but he has turned in some phenomenal performances.
I agree with you.
He may or may not be a great actor, but he's definitely a fine actor, and his performance in this movie is abysmal. His character is just dreadful. It's not just that he's a bad guy; it's that he's dreadful. He's the guy who's like, I'm not gonna fight next to any Negro. Yeah. And then, of course, the very last scene of the movie, he's standing next to the shoulder to shoulder with the black guy, and he goes, I'm proud to stand alongside of you today. And I'm just like, stop.
Right. You know what that was? That was the scene in Return of the King where Legolas and Gimli are like, I never thought I'd die standing next next to an elf. How about fighting side by side with a friend? I can do. And I'm getting misty just recounting that.
Because it was done right.
Yes. This, not so much. Can I read you my note about Donald Logue?
Please.
Donald Logue, he makes everything better. And then I added to this note as the movie went on. Except when he's playing a character whose sole distinguishing attribute is that he's racist. Then, not so much. I do, and I will say this. I do buy the transformation he undergoes.
Oh,
and
sure.
And I think the reason I do, although it's totally predictable, is because it takes the entire movie, or it takes like it takes the span of, you feel, not just because it's a close to 3 hour movie, but also because they take pains to describe the months and months going by.
Right.
When I say describe, I mean using film techniques. And the movie takes forever. It isn't, for example, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, there's a movie called The Object of My Affection, which is just wretched, where Jennifer Aniston falls in love with Paul Rudd, who is gay, and there is a character who literally is, he you don't know his politics until the moment the script needs a bad guy, then he is horribly homophobic, and then at the end, like, the instant they don't need him to be homophobic for the plot, he isn't homophobic anymore.
Right.
And that is not what this is. It's actually something that takes a while.
A racist guy who decides, after fighting and killing next to somebody for 9 months, maybe maybe it's possible that we're all not, you know, which is, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's how a lot of people, that is actually how you beat racism. I mean,
right.
basically, and sexism and homophobia basically is actually make people get to know and understand more about those people and
yes.
the other. And then you go, oh,
yes.
You know, maybe this person's not, you know, an animal.
Indeed.
Maybe.
Here's the funny thing. None of the ideas of the movie, like, I would be interested in seeing this movie made again with an actual, with a real good screenwriter and a real director.
Yeah.
Obviously certain plot points would have to be redone and it would be a different movie, but, like, this is the kind of movie I wouldn't mind seeing remade. Again, it would have to be shorter, it would have to cut out some plots, it would have to do all sorts of things and be more focused.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot say enough how much I despise Roland Emmerich as a filmmaker. I cannot. He has reached a special echelon for me.
Wow.
Where I am, there's one or two other people in that. Well, there's really one that I can think of. Other person, and that other person has actually made a couple movies I liked.
Wow.
So, I have long railed against Joel Schumacher, but I love The Lost Boys.
Sure.
And I really like Falling Down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. And I remember Flatliners being interesting, even if it didn't end up being great.
I agree with that.
So as much as I think Joel Schumacher mostly makes terrible things for a living, he has made at least two movies that I really liked.
Indeed.
So Roland Emmerich has made nothing that I liked. I understand that people love Independence Day,
mm-hmm.
and I understand why, but it's not aging well.
Agreed.
So I just think Roland Emmerich is a terrible human being.
Except for Randy Quaid's performance, which is timeless.
I agree with that. I agree with you. You know I agree with you.
Hello, boys.
Right.
I'm
yeah.
back. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Sure.
I think that Roland Emmerich probably thinks he loves America.
Yeah.
I think he thinks he loves America. He's a German immigrant who came to America, and I think he thinks he loves America.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate the way he looks at America. It disgusts me.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that it's because he's critical. I have no problem with people being critical of America. You and I saw that Cat Goldthwait movie, God Bless America, which I had a hard time with, and it wasn't a great movie, but I don't hate Bobcat Goldthwait for making it at all.
Sure.
And in fact, I think it's a movie for all its faults that I am glad to reckon with and think about. Whereas yeah. Roland Emmerich right. makes all these sort of like grand sweeping things, and I'm just like, he's about to make another alien invasion movie where America gets destroyed. I'm not kidding. It's his next film.
Are you serious?
I just read it. I am dead serious.
Great. Great. Okay,
this
let's
is
get
a guy. So everyone,
Emmerich.
So everyone. Roland Emmerich made Independence Day, which was famous for blowing up America. He made 2012, which was infamous for blowing up America and just exploding America with the end of the world. He made The Day After Tomorrow, which is infamous for destroying America. He just most recently has made White House Down, which is famous for someone attacking great landmarks in America. And now he's about to make another alien invasion movie on America. It's like, dude, I get it.
It's a metaphor. I got it. Roll it.
What is and Patriot is about America, really, yeah, ostensibly.
Yeah.
And it's a German and Australian making a movie about and two Australians making a movie about America. And I think Jolie Richardson might be something that's not American.
I think she's British.
So anyway, I'm not even looking it up. Let's just say she's British. You're British from now on, Jolie, even if you weren't.
Nice.
Okay, I'm done with what I want to say about Roland Emmerich.
Okay.
Go ahead. What do you want to say about this movie? Guide me into a better place.
The cast is... They're not all good in this movie, but it's an amazing cast. Heath Ledger, you can tell he's going to be a star. Chris Cooper, ain't nothing wrong
yes.
with that.
No, I love Chris Cooper.
Adam Baldwin, who is always awesome and always kind of shady.
Which one is he?
He's the guy who... he's the loyalist. He's the loyalist.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Che Cario, who the Frenchman, is just great. He's just awesome.
Yes, he is.
Like, if I'm going to die...
One of the few that emerges unscathed.
Right. If I'm going to die, at least I'll be well-dressed or whatever he says.
Yeah.
Jolie Richardson is... And I say this actually as a complaint. She is so unbelievably beautiful in this movie...
Yeah.
It is impossible to believe that she existed in colonial times. And I want to talk about that further because And I get that, like, our picture of like my mental picture of that era might not be 100% correct, but it wasn't like there was, you know, like human waste in the streets or anything like that. But it was, but their cleaning techniques were not as advanced as ours, just flat out.
She is pristine in this movie.
She is pristine. Everything is pristine in this movie, even when it's dirty. Even when they're like in a marsh.
It's perfectly dirty.
It's perfectly dirty.
Yeah.
And it's I'll be honest, it's frustrating because it's like, because it's like you clearly spent zillions of dollars on this movie. What are you doing? Put some of that toward the costume budget.
And her character, and she's fine. It's not her fault. It's her character is just there to be there. It's not.
Right. Yes.
I mean, to say the romantic subplot seemed tacked on is one of my favorite, like, you know, the romantic subplot seemed tacked on is like this great complaint about a movie.
Yes.
The romantic subplot was incredibly tacked on, and it was literally just to make sure that there was a love interest.
That's true. That is true.
It was just, I think Chris Cooper, the Frenchman, and probably, and Tom Wilkinson are the only ones that emerge unscathed from this film.
Tom Wilkinson, God, so.
Well, and Mel Gibson, actually. I think.
Yeah,
this,
I agree.
It's funny because it's such a bad movie, and yet Mel Gibson, it's while it's a bad movie, it is never a boring movie.
That's true. That's true.
And I would say that one thing that Roland Emmerich, I've never seen Godzilla, another movie where something destroys America.
It's true.
The movies of his I've seen, none of them were boring.
Yeah.
So that is the closest thing to a compliment you will get from me today, Mr. Emmerich.
Right.
But it isn't boring. It's got plenty of plot. And there's something going on, and Mel Gibson is just mesmerizing.
He is great.
He
is really.
He just carries. He literally carries the movie. Well, I guess not literally. It's not a literal thing, but I don't know what. But he quite honestly and unironically and very truthfully carries the movie.
Yes. Yes. I want to talk. I just want to say one more thing about race relations in this movie.
Sure.
The scene where the black guy joins up with the militia it's actually handled well at the beginning. And then yet again, just like, because by this point you already know that all of the black people working Mel's lands are free men. It's like, really? Like, I mean, come on.
Right.
So then he again solves the problem of slavery by treating the black guy better than the guy's master does. I mean,
right.
And what I want to know is, at that point, why include it at all? If you want to be jingoistic, just ignore those. If you want to be jingoistic and produce a piece of propaganda, ignore those parts that make you uncomfortable. This movie, and this is not the same thing, by the way, because this sounds like I'm saying. And I guess, I mean, I don't want to say that this is the only thing I think, but I'm 100% on this side. But like, we have said that you have a problem when they take real events and change them, and I have said that I don't really. And I'm not complaining from a factual standpoint. I'm complaining from a dramatic structure standpoint.
Right.
It's boring because it's middle of the road.
It's not just that. I don't think it's just not wanting to offend. I think it's one more layer of paint slathered on.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Just, it's red, white, and blue paint, and it's just slathered on this sort of light. Like, he is the ultimate because he didn't want to fight, but he fought for family, which is the only real reason ever to fight.
Right.
And it's the only real reason to truly understand freedom, because he understood freedom because he lived through things. He'd done things and seen more. And because of all this, he knew that you treat black people better. And so he actually, so of course all these black guys lived in South Carolina and worked on his plantation as free men. And if, by the way, if that were the case and they liked him so much, why weren't they in his militia? Like, seriously. Like, here's
right.
a whole movie. Like, anyways, there's no, you're right. It's just ridiculous. Either stay away from it all together. Or deal with it, but just please.
Yes.
Please.
There is a moment. One thing that you cannot say about Roland Emmerich is that he shies away from making a scene that he thinks could be exciting, right? And yet there is a weird cut in this movie when the British attack Jolie Richardson and all the kids and burn her house down. They escape and they're hiding in the woods. right next to her burning house. And
right.
and the British are searching the premises for these people, right? And then, and I'm like, oh my God, and I didn't remember this part from the first time I saw it. So I was like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? And it just cuts to the next morning with the family walking up the road. And it's like, really?
So you got out of it by just assuming, like they were like, oh, they're not in here. Should we check out in that tree line right there? Nope. Nope. Mike Myers might be out there. I'm not going out there.
That's right.
There
That's
are
right.
some scary things in those woods.
That's right.
I don't know.
And
don't
of
know.
Course, where does the family go? They go to hide with the black workers because Roland Emmerich is single-handedly repairing and elevating race relations in the United States of America.
Yeah, and I should have. Yeah. And by the way, when I said Mike Myers is hiding in the bushes, I didn't mean Michael Myers from Halloween. I meant literally Wayne from Wayne's World is hiding in the bushes, just telling obnoxious jokes until people tell him to go away.
Right. Spoilers. The scene where Heath Ledger dies was actually surprising to me. I was actually surprised.
Yeah. Yes.
Both certainly when I saw it last time, and it is still effective. Like you just don't see it coming. You don't see it coming. Having said that, and I don't like speaking ill of people. I really don't. The girl, the woman who plays his love interest and then wife, is so bad. She is, it's not just that she's bad, it's that she is a modern person and she can't play older. Like, for example, one of the great unsung performances in the Back to the Future movies is Leah Thompson. Because you believe that she's a 1950s girl. You just do.
Yeah.
I don't ever believe that this girl is not a late 20th, early 21st century girl.
Right. Right.
And also, she's not a good actress.
She may or may not be. I mean, I think the problem is this is a hard movie to decide.
That's fair.
I haven't seen her in other things that I can think of. So I'd like to look at her filmography and decide if that's the case. But I will say, at least as of right now, if this is the only thing she did, okay, maybe she needed to go do something else, you know, for a while.
Yes.
But I hear what you're saying, and I think there is one. And yeah, I don't care about spoilers at all in this situation. There's one scene that is just utterly and unquestionably effective. And that is, the scene that begins with his youngest kid, with Heath Ledger being arrested again. And one of MG's kids dying, getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
And ends with Mel Gibson's siege on the soldiers with his two sons. From the beginning of that to the end of that sequence is a nearly perfect sequence.
Yes.
It is legit. And by the way, I don't know if you noticed, one of his sons who trembled and frowned is the same kid who was trembling and frowning as his son in Ransom, which is Nick Nolte's son.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So you got a little of that going on.
One of his other sons, real quick, the youngest son, is Logan Lerman, who is the lead in Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Nice.
He only has one or two lines in the movie. Maybe.
Wow.
I think he only has one.
I'm going to have to relook at that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So anyways, but that sequence where they all see what his dad is really made of.
Yes,
it's,
I agree.
It's prime Mel Gibson, man. I mean, it is. And it's like, I almost feel like when you think of the sequence of the in the Independence Day, when they're like, these spaceships are placed strategically like chess pieces,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden you see them explode all the different things around the world,
mm-hmm.
you almost feel like that was like, that's the shot that made Roland Emmerich go, I want to make this movie. And I almost feel like this sequence is why Roland Emmerich wanted to make the movie.
Interesting.
But it's so well done.
Yeah.
And I never thought of it until just now either.
Yeah.
But it's so well done. And then it just, it's this great idea that just the rest of the movie completely and utterly fails to live up to.
I agree with that.
But it's like, if I was going to make a remake, it's the one scene that if I was watching, if it was on, I would totally watch that scene.
Yes.
I would totally watch that scene. And pretty much that scene alone.
Yeah.
Maybe the tete-a-tete between Tom Wilkinson and MG.
Yes.
I love the two of them together.
Yes. And the dogs are gorgeous and amazing.
And hilarious. And fantastic.
Yes. I grew up with a Great Dane, so I'm predisposed.
Did you really?
I did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How old did he live to be?
Old. 13, 14. Real old for a Great Dane.
That's crazy. They only live to be like 9 or 10. Fascinating.
I know.
You got a ghost Dane?
No.
Okay, sorry.
Nope.
I apologize. I didn't mean to speak up.
It's all good. It's all good. I do want to point out we have a primo Mel Gibson cry in this movie over Heath Ledger. It's restrained, it's prolonged and protracted, and it is just...
Why don't you tell the audience why you're bringing this up?
It is my opinion, and it is Phil's opinion, that Mel Gibson is the greatest male crier in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He's really good at it.
When you were saying it just then, I was like, I'm not sure I'm ready for Andy to speak for me on that. And then as you were saying, by the time you finished the sentence, I was like, no, I am. That's fine. You can say that. I think we're on the same page here.
And as I was saying it, I was like, I wonder if Phil will let me speak for him. And I was like, well, he won't have a problem disagreeing with me if he does.
Nope. I think I disagreed with you at the beginning of the sentence, and by the end of the sentence, I was like, no, that's right. Yeah. That's right. He is the best. He is the best male crier in film.
It's true.
Amazing.
It's true.
He does it often. He does it differently.
Yes.
Depending on the movie, mm-hmm. he does it well. See, like, I love De Niro's cry, but it's the same thing in every. It's like he looks the same.
Agreed.
De Niro crying always looks like De Niro crying, but Mel Gibson crying it's an actual expression of acting. Oh,
yes.
Man, it's just
yes. It's a snowflake. Everyone is different.
I love that. I love that. Mel Gibson's tears are like snowflakes.
The last thing I want to say is this is an epic movie, and so you're going to have at least one epic battle scene,
yep.
and there are a few, and I actually don't think they're shot very well. Like, they're not shot as well as Braveheart. They're not shot as well as Rob Roy. They're not shot as well as any number of epic war movies.
Yep.
Having said, especially the last one, it's almost, I won't go so far as to say it's incoherent, but what makes a good battle scene, in my opinion, is setting out the geography.
Yeah.
The filmmaker's responsibility is every time you cut at the beginning, it needs to show another part of it so that very, very early on, everyone in the audience has a mental picture of where everything is, because otherwise it's just a bunch of people throwing themselves at each other, and it's not chaotic in a way that works in a movie.
It's just for the sake of showing violence, really. Show a guy's head get knocked off with a cannonball and stuff
that was,
like that, just
I mean,
to
that
show
was
it.
Kind of amazing. And
oh, sure,
like,
sure. Yeah.
Where it rolls and like takes out the guy's leg below the knee. Yeah.
Which is what would happen, and that's fine.
Yes.
I'm guessing, but that's fine. But you're right, and I would go. I think, look, great battle sequences, great action sequences, great sports sequences.
Mm-hmm.
The responsibility of the filmmaker is to make sure that the person who's watching is able to understand what's going on, even if they don't know anything about the sport, even if they don't know anything about battle strategy.
Yes.
That's just the rules, okay? You have to make it make sense, because it's like, otherwise you're telling a story that only you know. That, I mean, it's like you're telling a story. It's almost like you're telling a story to someone else and I'm walking by and hear details. Yeah. Like, I'm missing pieces here, which is funny because he paints the brush so thick with so many things, and he clearly gets so excited about making a movie with violence that you think he would then do better at the violence.
Well, what I find interesting is, for example, all of the aerial battles in Independence Day are well shot, you know?
Sure.
And they are chaotic. Like, you get the sense of, oh no, everything's going to pot. What are we going to do? But you're never like, wait a minute, where are they? You know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
I do.
And so it's weird that, like, and... I mean, I don't know this, but I would assume that's harder because you're working on the Z-axis as well. Like it's because you're in the air, you're not on the ground, right?
Sure.
So I found that interesting and disappointing. I did like...
When a great war movie doesn't have great war scenes, it's problematic.
It is. I did like the final fight between Gibson and Isaacs. I thought it was brutal. It was satisfyingly brutal.
But it has that moment where he's basically beaten, and he's facing away from the guy who's about to take his sword and cut his head off,
mm-hmm.
and then he just ducks at exactly the right moment,
which makes no sense at all.
I'm sorry. Can you hear a sword flying through the air? Right. Maybe you think you can. I don't think that you can.
I don't think you can either.
I bet Bruce Lee could.
Bruce Lee can do anything.
But Bruce Lee could play ping pong with nunchucks. So that's sort of how I feel about that. So but other than that, forget it. Look, and here's the thing. This is an incredibly high grossing film. Roland Emmerich is one of the most successful money wise filmmakers in American history.
Yes.
And some people, if like he were to watch this, like I always like, oh, if Mel Gibson were watching this, listen, Mel, you were great in this. If Roland Emmerich were watching this, sir, I wish you the best as a human being. I think you're terrible as a filmmaker. And like the whole like, well, it's made this much money.
Is not.
You mean nothing to me. Like your money, I don't care. I don't care.
Yes. It's true.
Just, and I know like I'm sounding like kind of, I'm going to, you know, look, get a little angry, get a little worked up.
Got a little online yourself.
A little online. I like movies and I like Mel Gibson and I like America. And again, I like America in such a way that you can be critical of her and that's fine with me.
Yes. That's part of liking America.
That I really believe that. I really believe that. I just feel like this movie is, and it's not boring. So I think if this movie was boring, I might hate it less.
I see.
Because if it was boring, I'd just be like, oh, God, that was just so boring. Like,
yeah.
I wasn't as angry watching Million Dollar Hotel as I was watching this.
Oh,
and I think part of – and I think – well, let me say why. And let me say why.
Okay.
Because Million Dollar Hotel, the whole time I was like, this guy, they're experimenting and failing terribly. But Roland Emmerich was like, I'm going to throw tons of money in every single actor and make this gorgeous and then make a terrible thing. And I'm just like –
I see.
That's what frustrates me. Like, I'll take a ridiculous, chaotic – hour and a half long failure over a 3-hour, like, expensive, really lavish, and even well-paced terrible thing.
That's a fair assessment, and that's a fair viewpoint. I am.
And maybe I'm madder because I liked it at first, and now I don't. That's also
fair.
Like,
no, that's a brave thing to admit. I wonder if I disagree with you or don't view the two movies the same way because I mean, the cardinal sin for me for a movie is to be boring.
I am 99% with you.
I enjoyed that about, in heavy quotation marks, I enjoyed that about Million Dollar Hotel as well because it was clear they were experimenting. And I love the idea of the noble failure. I just think that in addition to failing as a movie, it also failed because it was just interminable.
But, right. Now, what's funny about you saying that is that if Million Dollar Hotel and Patriot were both on television right now and I could only watch one, it would be The Patriot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I may be angrier about The Patriot, but if the two were playing in, I mean,
yes.
Or I'd just smash my face against the television until either the television were broken or I was unconscious.
Here's
that could be the third option.
Read a book.
Book.
In my day, television was called books.
Nice.
Yeah?
Nice.
Yeah?
As you wish. All I'll say is they recently made a TV show out of the Bible, so now I don't even have to read that anymore.
Nice. Amen. Literally.
Because I'm sure that it's really, really accurate and well done.
Indeed. I have no doubt. Are we done? Can we be done talking about this movie? All right.
Yeah.
So that's The Patriot. Coming up the next 3 weeks, What Women Want.
Excited.
A lot of W's. A lot of W's. Ooh. What Women Want, followed
and?
By We Were Soldiers.
We were soldiers.
And then 3 weeks from now, Signs. M. Night Shyamalan doing his thing with
maybe
now.
The last thing that he did that was something.
Yeah. And
his highest grossing film and Mel Gibson's highest grossing film.
Oh, fascinating. I didn't know that.
We I stand by the fact that this is a very interesting time to be watching the Mel Gibson. Like this right now, absolutely. This section is a really interesting time. It is just full bore. Although he just did made $1 Million Hotel, which is an indie flick, you're basically full bore big budget flicks.
That's true.
And set pieces. And What Women Want is a romantic comedy. We Were Soldiers is a Vietnam War epic. And then what comes after that?
Signs.
And Signs is a sci-fi suspense thriller.
And not only that, it's him working with the guy that at the time was being called the next Spielberg.
Yeah. So, no, I mean it's a very fascinating time, and yeah. Andy plays a former priest, of course. So you know that I'm going to be interested. We'll be talking. I think we might have a couple. I might have a couple things to say about that when the time comes.
Really, there's religious symbolism in the movie Signs.
Yeah.
I don't know. Right. So guys, don't see The Patriot if you haven't. Although looking at the box office grosses, you probably have.
You probably have, yeah.
You probably have.
Well said, my friend.
So hopefully you've enjoyed this discussion of The Patriot more than we enjoyed watching the movie. And that will bring us to the end of another installment of Project Millway, brought to you by the Gibsonian Institute.
Andy?
Yes?
I'd just like to say, if they enjoyed this listening to this half as much as I enjoyed talking with you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be in good shape.
There we go. Right back at you. We're Second Breakfast. I'm Andy Roth, and that's Phil Duvall. We'll see you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. The most important meal of the day, Second Breakfast.